Mark this on your calendars. The Partially Examined Life live show election special at Brown University will be on October 27th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about Alexis de Tocqueville and the problem with democracy. For more information, see partiallyexaminedlife.com. We will post a live stream of the event to our Facebook page.
The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
You're listening to Partially Examined Life. This is episode 146, part 2, continuing on Emmanuel Levinas's Time and the Other. In the first half, we talked about what is it for something to exist?
Or to be an existent.
Yes, to be a distinct, well, conscious thing, at least. We're not sure about non-conscious things. But is to stand out from the mass of the there is, which is undifferentiated being. To be an individual at all is to be master over its own existence. That is what it is to be an existent, at least for creatures like us.
You know, the present is important because we are thinking of the hypostasis as this emergence of consciousness as something starting out from itself. You know, he says at one point, the present comes from itself. It receives nothing from the past. The idea is that this existent is not simply a function of the past, like a non-conscious thing. There's some sort of freedom. To talk about the importance of the present is to talk about that rupture, the rupture that brings about the existent, but also the temporal rupture that makes it a free consciousness. Those two things go together.
And just to reflect back on methodology a little bit, what kind of observation is this supposed to be? It's supposed to be something about our experience, but our experience is sort of ambiguous in that I think you could say, of course, I don't perceive the present as starting out from itself and as wholly free and unconnected to any past. I perceive the present, at least the way we ordinarily think of things. If you focus on any single thing around you, it strikes you of, you know, well, how did it get there? Who made it? Where did it come from? Everything is presented, as Searle would say, as causal all the way down. But he's saying, in a certain sense, I guess the question is, what is the certain sense? What is the experience that is supposed to give rise to this idea? Because, yeah, it seems like, just like I was saying, Augustine was saying that, you know, that only the present is real. The past is not real. The future is not real. So I think he's channeling Bergson. I think this is one of his analyses of time, that the present presents itself as a creative force. So that's why we get the idea of a beginning right there in time. The fact that I'm looking at it now makes it a beginning. But what do you guys think of that as an observation?
Well, I think it's important to point out on 54, he's going to explicitly say that when he's talking about the present, he's talking about something non-experiential. And even the I and the I or the ego, he's thinking about primarily at first as a mode of existing, he calls it. But then once the hypostasis is complete, or hypostasis is complete, then you get the I or the self or the ego as we know it. And then you get experiential time after those things are complete. But we're talking about the event of hypostasis. When we talk about the present in that context, we're not talking about something experiential. But if we wanted to relate it to experience, so for instance, what it means to be present as opposed to be, say, thinking about the past or the future.
He says, philosophers have always recognized that the I is not really a substance, and yet it is kind of the preeminent thing that we struggle. In essence, he's putting his finger on the fact that we struggle to describe what consciousness is. It's not a thing in the way that, like, objects are things or our bodies are things. It's more of an activity. It's more of an event. As he says, the I is not initially an existent, but a mode of existing. And properly speaking, it does not exist. But of course, we can think of it as a thing. We can make it existent, and we can turn it into an object of our own self-reflection. And we can do the same thing with the present. We can think of the present as a thing. We can think of ourselves, our consciousness, the I, as a thing. And he says, and one can have a Kantian or Bergsonian experience of this hypostasized Now, is that hypostasized? How do I say that, Mark?
Well, see, this is actually spelled with two T's, hypostatized. And I thought hypostasis was just a noun form of this, where to hypostatize something is just to make it into a thing.
Right, reification, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Which we've talked about in other contexts. And he says, you know, listen, if you want to think of the I as a thing and you want to make it an object for consciousness, self-consciousness, aka, or if you want to think of the present as a thing and make it an object for consciousness, then you are experiencing hypostatized time, something that is. It is no longer time in its schematic function between existing and the existent. Time is the pure event of hypostasis. What he's driving at here is that consciousness, the mystery of consciousness, which is the great mystery of our time. We've had multiple podcasts on it. We've talked to many brilliant people who are trying to figure out what it is. And he's really kind of driving home that it's even more mysterious, even more of a challenge for us than we think it is. Because even the way that we're thinking about it, where we're trying to reify it and figure out what it is, misses the mystery of it itself, which is that it isn't.
I don't like the word mystery there, but go
ahead. Okay, sorry.
Because mystery is a technical term.
Yeah. No, I know. This to me is somewhat of a mystery too, but it's a mystery in the sense of you don't know the why. But anyway, I thought this was really clever, and I also think it's very profound to make our notion of ourself and the struggles that we have with that notion of self, continuity through time, identity, consciousness, the focal point of this moment where it is the thing through which we begin our phenomenological analysis, but it also then becomes the thing that we have to transcend, not just methodologically with phenomenology, but that ethically and ontologically, it's the way we overcome it itself. And this is a very big and important thing for me.
The other thing, just before we move on from the section, so he says the present, he's speaking non-experientially, and he's saying it's a function. It's a mastery of the existent over the existing. And then he goes on to talk about that in terms of freedom. This mastery over existing is, I think, synonymous with freedom and also with what he calls the quote-unquote virile power of the subject. This is not, I mean, he takes pains to say it's not free will in its fullest sense because we're still at a lower level here. It's the freedom of beginning. It's the freedom of starting out. And then he says, quote, it's the freedom included in every subject and the very fact that there is a subject, that there is a being, it is the freedom of the existent in its very grip on existing. Which reminded me of Simone de Beauvoir, incidentally, since she brought up that paradox of if we are free, if we do have free will, how we could ever fail to be free. And then there's the sense in which we are free in this lower level sense, but that free in the fuller sense of free will involves executing, acting. So anyway, I thought it was interesting that we get this sort of proto-freedom out of the present and the hypostasis. Along with subjectivity and consciousness comes this freedom.
So just to add a little more of her language, so if you have actual free will, then you are guilty if you do the wrong thing. Whereas even if you haven't willed one way or the other, you're still responsible.
Right.
You're accused. That made that sort of freedom, which again, she was pulling from Sartre, more palatable. That I usually don't like the emphasis in Sartre on freedom because really, I chose this. I chose to become this kind of person. I chose from birth. I was choosing this and now I'm, well, yeah, you kind of were. Not that you made a reflective choice, but you were acting as an existent. Even if everything you did was ultimately determined by chemicals, you still, as an existent standing out from the background.
But also you can, I mean, for the existentialist, right, you can assume responsibility for the past and all its effects for who you are. Even though obviously you had no control over all the events that made you who you are and over who you are, you're stuck with it. It comes out of the past. This is the ambiguity part of things again, right? You can still assume responsibility for it in the sense of saying, yeah, that's me. I'm an asshole. That's who I am.
Well, and Levinas is telling us on page 55 why we would associate ourselves with that. It's because we're the same material object. We're the same body. And so that ultimately is going to be what that really means to identify with yourself, to be led back in the return to self, is to be occupied with yourself, is to be a material body. The fact that your body is bugging you with its desires and pains and blah, blah, blah. So you want to read some quotes from that section, or are we?
Yeah, let's move on to solitude and materiality. I don't think the solitude and hypostasis, it's not like there's that much, much in there.
Existing is mastered by the existent that is identical to itself, that is to say, alone. But identity is not only a departure from self, it is also a return to self. The present consists in an inevitable return to itself. The price paid for the existent's position lies in the very fact that it cannot detach itself from itself. The existent is occupied with itself. This manner of being occupied with itself is the subject's materiality. Identity is not an inoffensive relationship with itself, but an enchainment to itself. It is the necessity of being occupied with itself. Beginning is made heavy by itself. It is the present of being and not of a dream. Its freedom is immediately limited by its responsibility. This is its great paradox. A free being is already no longer free because it is responsible for itself.
So let's say what materiality means here. I mean, on the one hand, it's just the fact of having a body, but it's also the fact of having needs that we have to fulfill and desires and things like that. And I think this goes towards, Mark, towards what you said before. So it's kind of a reference to our narcissism or our egotism, or what Freud called ego instincts, our self-care, to use a more Heideggerian term. Everything sort of comes back to the self. We are occupied with ourselves. And as a great quote later on in the section, every undertaking is a sort of domestic stirring. So whenever we reach out towards the world, whenever we want something, desire something in the world, it's desire for ourselves. There's always that self-referential return. And that's what I think he means here by return to the self.
I thought the domestic stirring just referred to the fact that whenever you do anything, you kind of have to muster yourself up to do it. You know, if you want to leave the house, you got to deal with your own potential fatigue and indifference and all the stuff that fights you leaving the house.
No, because before that, he's talking about us being occupied with ourselves. The domestic part of it is just that there is metaphors that we are a house, we are a structure with things going on inside it. So in a state of desire, we don't think of ourselves as this dimensionless thing with a desire vector out there in the world, like we're a point. We are a house, we are a structure, and it's the stirrings within that that give us that desire vector. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a really good Halloween costume idea, to be a dimensionless thing with a desire vector. I want to do that.
It could look quite phallic, actually.
I don't even have to wear a costume.
There's a great quote about being, the relationship with itself, as in Blanchot's novel, Aminadab, the relationship with a double chain to the ego, a viscous, heavy, stupid double, but one the ego is with precisely because it is me. This with is manifest in the fact that it is necessary to be occupied with oneself. Every undertaking is a sort of domestic stirring. So occupied with oneself as in self-absorbed, or again, that self-referential aspect, even when desire is turned outward, there's another arrow. There's another finger pointing back at you.
This whole section refers to the conversation we had last time about this notion of the non-intentional self and the ego, the intentional self, consciousness, that to become free of the undifferentiated existing and to become an existent, to become self, is to become self-conscious, which ironically means that you buy your freedom at the cost of being chained to yourself. That's solitude, right? This is the great paradox. A free being is already no longer free because it is responsible for itself. You cannot achieve self-consciousness. You cannot depart from yourself never to return again. You always have to return. And that's what he's trying to get at. This is still these same echoes of this notion of solitude, that consciousness.
Yeah. So to be free, you have to wake up. But if you wake up, then you're worried about yourself, which is automatically enslaving. It's like being enslaved to the self. So that's the paradox of waking up.
Mm-hmm. Later in that same paragraph is the first place where he seems to use multiple terms for the self. He says the materiality is the concrete event of the relationship between ego and self. So it's moi and soi, or moi and soy, if you pronounce in phonetic English, M-O-I-S-O-I.
If you're a heathen, yes.
It's to reduce it to an ontological event. So I jumped on that because remember we read the whole book by Sartre about the transcendence of the ego and the difference between the thing that is doing, the subject, and the self, which is really an object, which is really like your character, is this thing that's built up over time, that's public. And so there's a difference between what Kant was calling the transcendental ego, what Sartre was criticizing. You know, what is the thing that has the experiences, and what is the self, the public thing that is this body, is this character. So the ego, I assume the moi, is the correlate of the transcendental ego. So it's the subject, right? The ego is the subject and the self is the object?
Yeah, the self is the non-intentional object, self that is the object of self-consciousness, and the ego is consciousness.
Well, why would you say if you are explicitly reflecting on yourself, then the self is the intentional object? It's not the non-intentional object. I think the point last time was that if you're focusing on, this is at least Sartre's way of explaining it, if you're focusing on something else, if you're focusing on your food, the self is hanging there like this viscous, heavy, stupid double. And so it's the self. It's still, as Wes was saying, you're seeking out for the food because it's for the self. I might say, just going more with Sartre's image, that it's there as part of the background, that you're pulling it around wherever you go. You've got this buildup. Whereas if you're really just being present in the moment, maybe you could forget the self. Maybe you could just focus on the food that you're eating or whatever the activity that you're doing and kind of forget about yourself. It would still be your ego that's doing it, but the self would be nowhere to be seen. But then once you kind of get self-reflective, oh, there it is. You see the stupid, dumb, heavy, viscous double that again. The relationship between ego and self is not an inoffensive reflection of the spirit upon itself. It is the whole of human materiality. So if the spirit there is the ego, literally, it's not reflecting on itself. It's reflecting on the self. Ego is not reflecting on ego. Ego is reflecting on self. The ego is nothing. There is nothing to reflect on. It is the activity of doing. So the freedom of the ego and its materiality, which is its being tied to a self, thus go together. Solitude is not tragic because it is the privation of the other, but because it is shut up within the captivity of its identity, because it is matter. To shatter the enchainment of matter is to shatter the finality of hypostasis. It is to be in time. Solitude is an absence of time. So we were saying solitude is the presence, but that's not all of time. The time given, itself hypostatized and studied, the time the subject travels by carrying its identity, is a time incapable of loosening the tie of hypostasis.
I think the reason he wants to make this connection, he uses the term materiality, is that he's setting the stage for the idea that you cannot transcend or escape materiality in space. You can only escape it in time. And so I had a problem when he first introduced the concept of materiality in this section. I didn't understand what he was meaning because he is explicit in saying that it's not that you have a body.
He says it's not because you have a body? I thought he said it was. It's exactly because you have a body.
I mean, he will say, it's not a fall into body. I mean, I think materiality is associated with having a body, but you're
consequently,
right.
Consequently, materiality does not express the contingent fall of the spirit into the tomb or prison of the body.
Right. But that doesn't mean it's not associated with having a body. It's just that that's the way materiality is typically thought of in contrast to freedom. But for him, materiality accompanies freedom. It's predicated upon freedom. It's not like you have the spiritual part and the bodily part and they're at war with each other. Materiality comes out of freedom. In fact, I think he says that right after where you read.
No, it's freedom comes out of materiality.
Yeah.
It is one and the same. But it's exactly the opposite of what, right, just to read the whole quote that Seth started reading.
Materiality accompanies necessarily the upsurge of the subject in its existent freedom.
Okay, so accompanies. It's not
accompanies necessarily. So it's a necessary result of freedom, right?
Well, and, again, accompanies doesn't mean result. It just means accompanies.
Well, what you mean is there's correlation without causation here. It just happens to to stop by. And it's clear why materiality comes with freedom, right? It's because the way in which desire is implicated in both of those things. The materiality is like heteronomy in Kant. It's like being chained to desire.
Can I rewind just a second? There's another little subtle thing. Just before that section we were just reading. My being doubles with a having. I am encumbered by myself. And this is material existence. So he's introduced an idea of responsibility, ownership, or having, materiality, mm-hmm. all in this one kind of short little section of the... I think he's sort of laying the groundwork for saying that we think of these as being ontologicals in the traditional sense of being and not being, but he's introducing elements of the ethical already, which is what he's going to eventually be driving to. But the language that he's couching it in, he's using value language and ethical language. And somehow, just in the same way that consciousness implies or comes with the present, that you cannot have consciousness without simultaneity, which is the present that's not time as we understand it, but present in a way that doesn't exist in the anonymous existing. In the same way, consciousness of self comes with responsibility and a sense of having, which is materiality. So materiality, consciousness introduces the idea of the present, but it also introduces the idea of ownership, which somehow implies materiality.
So I still think materiality is the ontological version of having a body, of having a self that's part of the empirical world. So he says, to understand the body starting with its materiality, the concrete event of the relationship between ego and self, is to reduce it to an ontological event. So in other words, it's not identical to having a body. It's sort of, again, the deep metaphysical basis of having a body, which in a way you could say that for a lot of these concepts, like the other. The other is not literally another person, but the ontological basis of that. So I think embodiedness and materiality really do importantly go together. You know, I have to worry about death. I'm worried about my body being destroyed or meeting my needs, my instinctual life. All of that stuff is predicated on having a body. So the enchainment, I think, really is to those things. It's just that, you know, as in a Christian tradition, instead of seeing the body and the soul as these two different metaphysical substances at war with each other, the materiality is just an expression of the spiritual side. It is necessarily accompanies.
Well, so that takes us very nicely to part two. We're finally to page 58, where we're moving toward what he's going to call salvation, which is getting rid of the just being occupied with yourself. He breaks from this step-by-step phenomenological bit for a few pages here and seems to talk about, I think, how his picture, as opposed to Heidegger's, mm-hmm. solves this conflict between snooty people like Heidegger.
Right, right.
And snooty socialists who look down on Heideggerian type philosophers as, oh, their heads are in the clouds and they're ignoring what really matters, so that we have the spiritual need that Heidegger is trying to address, or really any philosopher, and then the material needs that the socialists are trying to address. And each one of them thinks that their hermeneutic take, their interpretation of the human life situation, privileges their point of view, right? Come on, don't be distracted by the desires of the flesh. That's for sucks. That's for stupid people. Whereas the socialist is going to say, look, the only reason you're worried about your hoity-toity self-actualization, spiritual fulfillment, is because you're a rich person who already has the material needs met. And how about you open your eyes to the rest of the world? So you got that both of them kind of agree, seemingly, with there being a hierarchy of some sort. Whereas he wants to say that, no, material needs and spiritual needs are really, they're equally basic and they exist side by side with each other, because spiritual needs are not a matter of all my material needs are met and now I can reach for the sky. Spiritual needs come right out of the solitude of being a material body in the first place, of being an individual.
He starts out this whole section, the contrast is with Heidegger, for whom he says solitude really is the result of being toward death, about anxiety in the face of inevitability of our death. You know, everyday life and its material concerns end up being like diversions. We're distracting ourselves. We're being inauthentic. Whereas for Levinas, everyday life and its material concerns are not an expression of simply diverting ourselves and our inauthenticity and our unwillingness to face up to death. quote unquote, everyday life is a preoccupation with salvation. We are actually, through those day-to-day activities and those material concerns, seeking our salvation, not trying to escape it or engaged in a kind of fall where the body is at war with the spirit.
Is it weird that he's using this word? You know, he's not a Christian philosopher. He's not trying to sneak in some sort of analog to the Christian experience. Is there just a translation issue? What is this? Why salvation?
Isn't this whole book about salvation from solitude?
Yeah.
It just seems like you could call it something else if you weren't trying to connote. He must be trying to connote the religious notion there.
Well,
which is not a Jew. Is there any notion of salvation in Judaism?
Historically, it's taken the form of religion, right? Even if we don't think we're existentialists and we don't think that salvation requires religion, we're still on the same track, right, as thousands of years of history. Or am I wrong about that?
So there's not a notion of salvation in Judaism that's quite like the same notion in Christianity, I don't think. But if you're describing the experience of existence as solitude and horror and insomnia, then I think salvation's an appropriate word to use when you're talking about trying to escape that state.
Mm-hmm.
Salvation in the sense of rescue, but not rescue by another, in this case, kind of. But again, I tried to say earlier that he's using terms that we would call value-laden. Heidegger introduced this notion of talking about ontology using terms that sound psychological. And I think Levinas is just continuing to play on that. Now, he is going to go further. Heidegger was also certainly guilty of using religious terminology. There were certainly aspects of his religious upbringing that he snuck in and then, of course, would deny any of his religious influences. And there are a number of places, even in this text, where Levinas makes references to the Bible or to religion. So I don't think it's an accident that he's using the term salvation. But again, I think the only other word you would use in its place would be transcendence. And he's trying to avoid using the term transcendence, I think, because it falls in these traditional categories. And I think you can articulate transcendence in terms of knowledge or ecstasis, which won't do for him what he wants this to do.
Yeah, in fact, witnessing the other, you don't want to exactly describe that as you're not transcending yourself. I guess we'll get to this, but the other stays other. Although just for the record, you can't say that salvation is escape from horror and insomnia because the horror and insomnia had to do with the there is. So we've already escaped the horror and insomnia just by becoming existence, by being concerned with ourselves.
Right. It's the solitude now.
Yes, the solitude that is acute.
Yeah, and I think the interesting part of all this is that the daily lives and the extent to which we are concerned with material things and get absorbed in them is not just an escapism, and it's not a flight toward materiality, he's going to say. And again, when we get to this salvation through the world nourishment section, we're trying to, weirdly enough, escape from our materiality, to transcend our materiality, even when we're absorbed in enjoyments, sensations, things like that. And the sense in which we're trying to do that is we're trying to forget the self. We're trying to forget that enchainment to the self.
Yep.
The other interesting thing is here, you know, instead of this being sort of like a kind of ascetic morality set up against self-serving desire, both trends are, Mark, you said they're both basic, these preoccupations with higher and lower things, but he'll say that both of them are forms of morality, of abnegation. So these enjoyment is a kind of abnegation in its fleeing from the self. He calls it the first morality is the morality of earthly nourishments. So it's a really, again, there's a lot of irony and reversals in Levinas, the idea that nourishing ourselves and obeying those sorts of desires is not simply the thing that stands over and against morality. It's its own kind of morality. It's its own kind of asceticism in the sense of it leaves the self.
Hmm. There's a couple things going on in this initial section about this notion when he talks about enjoyment that Wes was just mentioning. He talks about Heidegger seeing the world through the concept of use and work.
Mm-hmm.
So Dasein for Heidegger has this comportment towards the world that is care. And it's care for how things function and how they can be used to accomplish the projects or the goals that Dasein has set out. And Levinas says very simply, yes, of course, we have an instrumental relationship with the world like that. But before we do that, we have a relationship of enjoyment. Yes, the world is an ensemble of tools, but before that, it's actually an ensemble of joys or nourishments. And if you think about the way a child experiences the world, their first experience of the world is through fascination and enjoyment, and the world comes to them as nourishment. And at a certain point, they begin to see the world instrumentally and start to grasp and try to manipulate and use things. Now, Levinas still wants to talk about priority. And so I find a way of justifying the notion of prioritizing nourishment over use in that developmental aspect, which may or may not be valid.
He's also trying to draw this contrast. So for Heidegger, we are absorbed in things. We're absorbed in this world of tools. And then we return from that to an authentic relationship with the self. And it's instrumental in getting us there, back to that authentic relationship with ourselves.
It was not that we're absorbed with the tools. In fact, if the tool is functioning properly, we don't even notice it.
Not with the tools. Did I say the tools? We're absorbed with things in the world.
We're absorbed in with, yes. But that could be our iPhone, which is the tool that then becomes the thing that sucks away our attention.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure. I don't know enough, actually, to say. But when Levinas calls the world instead an ensemble of nourishments, he goes on to talk about the ecstatic part of that, the sense in which we go outside of ourselves. And for the sake of going outside of ourselves, and that there's something inherently moral to that. We don't have to get the authentic part out of it. We don't have to bring ourselves back. So in other words, he talks about finality and the pleasure of the object, the sense in which we have this ecstatic experience. We're brought outside of ourselves, but the object is sort of a limiting factor. I don't know how to give a good example of that right now, even though he does. But he's trying to get at the sense in which everyday life, we're not trying to be more material. We're trying to be less material when we try and enjoy the world. That's what I sort of wanted to emphasize here. And we're trying to get out of ourselves. There's something inherently authentic about that for Levinas. We don't have to say, no, that's a diversion. And in order to make it authentic, we have to get back to ourselves somehow. We have to pull it back.
That's a good point, Wes. This whole section, this 5 pages or so, is a pretty thick and robust response to, we kind of gloss this first section where he talks about the feeling of solitude, where you're driven to denounce the joys of collective works and socialism. And then conversely, the idea of falling into the social construct and becoming part of the crowd. This is about what Heidegger has to say about Das Man. And it truly is about authenticity. And he makes the point of saying that whether you're talking about the individual asserting themselves or the individual becoming part of the collective, and these two things are antagonistic, the antagonism is a morality. They're not objecting to the fact or a metaphysical state of each other. They're objecting to the inauthenticity of one another. In the one, it says you should go after your own individual goals and deprioritize or ignore the collective will. And the other says you should be part of the socialist or the collective and deny those parts of yourself. This is not an argument about fact. It's an argument about authenticity and the authentic way of being. And he calls that out and then immediately transitions. By the way, here's another biblical reference, Mark. On page 61, he describes this individualism versus the collectivism. This antinomy opposes the need to be saved and the need to be satisfied, Jacob and Esau. But the true relationship between salvation and satisfaction is not that which classic idealism perceived, and that despite everything modern existentialism maintains. Salvation does not require the satisfaction of a need like a higher principle that would require the solidity of its basis to be secured. And so, because Heidegger goes on and talks about use and work, he goes on and says, hey, in that notion of enjoyment of the world where you lose yourself, you have an ecstatic experience where you move outside of yourself, it's still not salvation. So he sets up in that first part the discussion of salvation versus satisfaction, then points out how this ecstatic experience of nourishment, even though it becomes prior to the notion of use or care, still is not going to be sufficient for salvation, because even though you lose yourself, you're still limited by an external thing, an object in which you're losing yourself.
Yeah, that's a good point, Seth. So, yeah, one of the things in that section that he emphasizes is that we maintain a sort of distance from the object as well, which I think is what you were just talking about.
He's talking about salvation in general here. Everyday life and salvation. Can you achieve salvation through the collective social? No. Can you achieve salvation through the world? Certainly not through use, but maybe through nourishment or jouissance. No, that is not how you're getting there.
Yeah, in the transcendence and of light and reason section, he makes this explicit. In the luminosity of enjoyment and self-forgetfulness, we don't break this attachment of the ego to the self, even though we're trying. And then the way he explains that, it sounds like, here's a quotation, light is that through which something is other than myself, but already as if it came from me. So there's the sense in which these things are other than me, but they also are part of my consciousness. I think that's getting into Kant and things like that. That's the best way to look at this. So our knowledge of things, for instance, or our experience of things doesn't surmount our solitude, because it's as if the things out there are part of me.
Yeah, which is to say we experience them through knowledge, which is that way of making them part of ourselves.
Yeah. Before we go further, let's take a minute to talk about our sponsors.
Hey folks, like you, I am always looking for ways to enrich my life with more knowledge. And that is why Mark, Dylan, Wes, and I do this podcast, and why we get a chance to read great things, discuss them, and sometimes interview interesting guests. It's also why I continue to enjoy the Great Courses Plus, and I want you to try it as well. The Great Courses Plus offers a library of engaging online video lectures in so many topics presented by award-winning professors. Recently, I've been watching the course Passions, Philosophy and the Intelligence of Emotions by Mark Wessenei's common professor back at UT, Robert Solomon. It's particularly topical for me because I recently experienced a death in the family, and I had to attend a funeral and be with my extended family and grieving the loss of this very important figure in our family. And when I came back, I watched episode 9 about grief in Solomon's lectures on Passions, Philosophy, and the Intelligence of Emotions. Now, Solomon talks about grief understood as loss, which we think of as negative and which we oftentimes try to avoid. And he says, you know, the truth is grief is a richer emotion. And by working through Hegel and Goethe, he talks about how you constitute yourself through your relationship with another person. And when that other person dies, yourself, or at least that part of yourself that is constituted by that other, is shattered. And grief, rather than being negative, is really a positive process of reconstituting yourself after the loss of the other. This was very meaningful for me in my time of grief. With the Great Courses Plus, you get unlimited access to learn about hundreds of topics, including philosophy, religion, history, and science, and even some hobbies like photography and chess. You can stream these videos anytime, anywhere. You can start and resume from any device, including your mobile phone, tablet, laptop, or TV. So listen, I know you're going to get a lot out of and love the Great Courses Plus like I do, and I want you to sign up today because they're giving our listeners a special offer. It's a free month of unlimited access to all their lectures. So start your free month now by signing up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. For those suffering with an addiction problem who have unsuccessfully attended treatment, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone, and that treatment should address the multiple needs of an individual and not just the drug use. Recovery should move beyond coping with addiction to helping people thrive. Gulf Breeze Recovery's Thrive program is a holistic non-12-step treatment system that not only treats the true underlying cause of the addiction, but also addresses the individual's physical, spiritual, and mental needs. Gulf Breeze Recovery helps people discover a fresh new outlook on life that enables them to be captains of their own ship. The waterfront facility is neat, clean, comfortable, offers private and semi-private rooms, a lighted fishing pier, and a large swimming pool overlooking the water. You can view the webcam, take a virtual tour, and get more information at gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-9-HOLISTIC-REHAB.
I'd like to reflect a little more on the self and the morality that this reflects. I mean, we're going to, as with Hegel, this is just to relate to our long series that we've had now of different philosophers reflecting on how the self is built. Given how central the other is going to ultimately be here, although apparently not in our discussion tonight, I guess we talked about it enough last time, to have a fully fleshed out self, you need other people. You need other.
Right. We're going through the same, the same sorts of steps here where, our relationship to objects is not going to do it.
However, it looks like in his description of light and reason, in what nourishment and just really, he has a very Christian or Buddhist take on that we are by nature extremely selfish, that just by being an existent, we're doomed, as we were saying, to self-concern, to worrying about our bodies, worrying about our needs, worrying about our desires, and that on this Kantian take of perception and light, which is really understanding and talks about light and reason. So the fact that we can understand anything at all, the fact that anything comes to light means we recognize it in a very Kantian sense as somehow coming from us, which seems very strange to think that this is actually part of our phenomenological experience, as opposed to being some theory that Kant came up with. You know, even if it's a correct theory about the ultimate nature of perception, the fact that he seems to be saying that we experience these things as coming from us seems very strange to me. But in any case, that's his take, that everything ultimately refers to self. Whereas I would think that the typical Hegelian take is that we actually have quite a bit of lack of self. We're acting as subman. We're acting more or less blindly, not with explicit reference to self all the time, selfishness, selfishness, selfishness. In fact, as Heidegger would say, we are more likely to get sucked into things. We're more likely, again, I like Simone de Beauvoir's discussion of the subman, that before you gain a proper sense of self, then you're just likely to join whatever horrible war. So what do you think about Levinas? Seems ambivalent about that picture at the very least. He seems to think, have more of the traditional, no, we're all very self-concerned, and it's only when the other comes along that we have the ability to stop being so goddamn selfish.
Isn't that true? We got to learn to share.
So I don't think you have to wait till the other comes along. I think you're...
Who are you going to share with if there's no other?
Well, it's already there. If I may say, always already.
Clearly, the other is already there developmentally, but sort of in your maturity, you have to actually accept the gaze of the other and the responsibility that it pins on you in order to become a fully developed human being.
We start out as selfish little bastards, and then we... bump up against other human beings, and we have to respect their authority. No, respect them. Not that this is Levinas's, you know, because he's going to be giving an ontological version of this, which is more subtle. But
yeah, and we also want to be careful that Levinas is not offering a different path to authenticity through the other versus through the self, the way Heidegger. Authenticity is a form of self-affirmation that is totalizing. So he genuinely means something when he talks about salvation and transcendence that's somehow different than this notion of authenticity, which is not to say he's not driving towards something else, but I don't think that's the right word.
Let's finish maybe making the link between what we talked about today and what we talked about last time, which I think is in the suffering and death part. This is into part three, and part three is what we started, you know, supposedly we had read part three and four for last time, and the beginning of part three, last time I read it, was just bewildering. But now, actually going back and reading part one and part two, oh my gosh, it made so much more sense. Talking about suffering as hypermateriality, as being directly exposed to being, is what he says, that there's no refuge. So this is interesting. It kind of connects the, you know, I was upbraiding you, Seth, for saying that salvation was supposedly a leap away from insomnia and all this stuff. But by being individuals, we already have transcended the there is. But apparently not. Apparently,
we get a recapitulation of the there is here. Yeah.
Yes. Physical suffering is being stuck in the present, stuck in materiality.
It's the impossibility of nothingness, just like the there is. Yeah.
Yep.
It's like that eternal vigilance.
Does it refer to the self? Because it's the self suffering. And so it's sort of the self and its connection to itself seeming really unbreakable, and that's the problem? Or is it that you get lost in the suffering. You're not referring to self. You're not saying, woe is me. It's just pain itself obliterates the self. So it is more like getting sunk in the there is.
Because I thought he was going to say suffering does allow us to escape solitude.
Yeah.
By becoming pure suffering and no longer the solitary self.
What pain does is it makes you aware of that responsibility that we talked about before. It makes you aware of the impossibility of detaching yourself from yourself and your materiality. I had to look this word up. He says it's the very irremissibility of being. Pain and sorrow are the things that bring you back to yourself and your concern for your own existence, the work of your existence, more than anything else. So he's talking in this section about how Heidegger says when you go through the experience of anxiety about death, Angst vor dem Tod, that's how you come to realize the impossibility of possibility, the potential end of your own projection and existence. And through that experience of embracing that, you gain authenticity that allows you to escape the they and truly own your own experiences. And I apologize if that sounded jargony.
Let's at least pick out the impossibility of the possibility and then Levinas's reversal of that.
Yeah, the impossibility of possibility is that Heidegger says that Dasein, human beings, are projections into their possibilities in the future out of their past. You are your possibilities. And if you simply take on the possibilities that are given to you by chatter and the common points of view and whatever is socially acceptable, you're not truly embracing your own possibilities the way you could be. But if you project out to that future and take a look at death, which is the true end of all of your possibilities, there is no you anymore. There is no possibility. It's the impossibility of possibility. Then you have the chance to recognize that death is the one thing that you own. It's the one thing that's truly yours, right? It's Heidegger's articulation of that solitude. And when you recognize that, you'll be able to set your own course and sort of independent of, or at least without regard to, the social forces and the common forces that are swaying you to act this way or that way. And so it's all about authenticity, but you have to go through the prism of your own death to get there. And Levinas says death,
it's an unknown, so it's experienced as the impossibility of nothingness.
Yes.
Because it's like, it's again that whole there is thought experiment where you think beyond the end, you think of yourself as destroyed, but then again, there's still something left over.
So it can't be your death, as Heidegger thinks. Oh, it's your own most thing. It's your special death. You can't share it with anybody else. In fact, the fact that it's not going to be you, you can't experience death because you won't be there anymore. So we can't even imagine it.
He's not even saying that, I don't think. He's saying in our fantasy of what death means, the problem with it is we're not afraid of nothingness. We're afraid of...
It's not knowable.
The there is. We're afraid that it isn't nothingness. Because it's an unknown, in fact, we experience death as the impossibility of nothingness. That's the way we experience. We don't think of death as nothingness. We experience it as the impossibility of nothingness. What we're afraid of is the there is. The importance of that is that our relationship with death, this is the first time we get something where there's something that's truly an other. It's something that we're put into a relationship with something over which we have no mastery, which does not come from us, which we cannot know. It's a mystery. And so we experience death as our own passivity in relation to which we're no longer even a subject. This is the important pathway out of solitude.
So you might have thought, if you were Husserl, that every single thing of any sort that we experience, well, you know, at least physical objects are transcendent. They transcend our immediate experience of them. But because they have that predictable range of possible additional experiences, you could, you know, open it up, you could look at the back of it. Then he says, it's transcendence wrapped in immanence, that in the Kantian way, we somehow understand that all these things that we actually experience are only in our minds because we have certain faculties that helped construct them in that way. Whereas death, we just can't even get it in our heads at all. Everything else, even numbers, apparently, once you know it, it's like you've eaten it. You somehow sense it as you, as a part of you. I'm saying it this way because I don't believe that this is correct. I think that this is, you know, there was the big thing that Husserl and Frege discovered is that if you connect with the number four or this book in front of you, they do transcend. They are other in the same way that, well, not in the same way that death is, but in a significant way, in a self-escaping way.
Mm. So I thought that what he was trying to say was that if you call death the impossibility of possibility and you turn it into that thing that you use to self-generate your own authenticity, you're reifying it in the same way we were discussing earlier about existing and pure being as a verb. And that if you do that, the irony is that you're turning death into an object and you're creating that relationship of identification. And that
and you treat it as an object of mastery. Right?
An object of mastery. You master yourself and your own authenticity through a mastery of death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so his criticism of Heidegger is that he's established already that you cannot transcend solitude through that type of mastery. He just thinks that that Heideggerian approach, which is still novel in its way and recognizes something important about death, it just fails to acknowledge that by virtue of still being caught up in this, it wouldn't be knowledge in Heidegger's case, but it would be understanding. So the key is to recognize that death is something wholly other, something that I cannot reify, I cannot thematize, I cannot master, comprehend, understand. But I become aware of that. I approach death in suffering. So he basically is saying, it's not like you have this intellectual experience of death as being the impossibility of possibility, and that's like a form of apophantic enlightenment about your own authenticity. Instead, you suffer and you have an actual physical experience of privation and pain that puts you in the vicinity of death. And the key difference is, A, it's experience, and this is something that's not intellectual, but rather experiential, or, you know, and B, it's passive instead of active. In Heidegger's case, you're still doing that mastery activity thing. But in the case of suffering, it's pure passivity. Pain is happening to you. You are not acting to engage pain. Pain happens to you, and it brings you back to the fact that you cannot escape, that it's your pain, and that it's your immediate present existence. Pain is not something that happens. It's not a temporal. It's not in the past. It's not a memory. It's an immediate present physical thing, material, sorry, thing.
And he says death is within it as a paroxysm.
So for Heidegger, death, right, it's the impossibility of possibilities. I think that's the way you put it, Seth. Where
yeah.
For Levinas, it's the impossibility of nothingness. That's one thing he mm-hmm. he makes clear. And then this, for Heidegger, you master the idea of your own death in order to make possible all your other possibilities, which is to say to live authentically with your projects. And with Levinas, you don't master the idea, you come up against something before which you're totally powerless and passive, and that's its importance.
There's a nice passage, page 69 in Time and the Other. The content of suffering merges with the impossibility of detaching oneself from suffering. So suffering brings you towards this whole idea that your existence is the work of your existing. And this is not to define suffering by suffering, but to insist on the sui generis implication that constitutes its essence. In suffering, there is an absence of all refuge. It is the fact of being directly exposed to being. It is made up of the impossibility of fleeing or retreating. It is the fact of being backed up against life and being. In this sense, suffering is the impossibility of nothingness, which is that phrase that Wes just mentioned.
So that suffering is the impossibility of nothingness, not death is the impossibility of nothingness.
But suffering is the gateway drug to death.
Yes, it is a paroxysm within suffering. It is given.
He will say later that death itself is experienced as, so the unknown of death, which is not given straight off as nothingness, but is correlative to an experience of the impossibility of nothingness, signifies not that death is a region from which no one has returned and consequently remains unknown as a matter of fact. The unknown of death signifies that the very relationship with death cannot take place in the light, that the subject is in a relationship with what does not come from itself. We could say that it is in relationship with mystery. So we get something that's the first thing that's truly other.
So death is sort of given within suffering, but as something anticipatory, as something that, you know, would be potentially the end of suffering, but it's the thing that we fear. So it's not actually given in suffering.
No, it's not given as something that would be the end of the suffering. He says it's the event beyond the end of suffering that could be worse than suffering. It's the impossibility of nothingness thing again. So the idea here is not that, oh, death is unimaginable because if it happened to me, I wouldn't go on being. It's that the idea we have of death, he's saying, is precisely the idea of us persisting in some sense instead of being nothing. Like the fact that I can't imagine, really imagine the nothingness of death means that I imagine it as an existing or as the there is, which is a fate worse than death.
And so is this an inauthentic view of death?
No. He's trying to make the point that death is something so completely unknown, so complete a mystery, so completely other, that we can't even approach it, as he says, in the light, which is to say, as an object of knowledge, as something to be understood. And what he's saying is, approaching something in the light is to approach it from the perspective of knowledge, the term he used, virility, right? It's activity, it's active. And he's actually flipping it on its head and saying, no, death can only be approached passively, which means to say you don't actively reach out and approach death. Something impinges on you, makes you suffer, puts you in pain. And it's only then that death becomes a reality for you. Death becomes something that you can approach, but you don't actually approach it. It comes to you through this thing, through suffering. And it comes to you as this complete unknown that could be a release from suffering, but it could be horrible, right? It could be terrible.
The important point is that it's the first thing that we get that is truly, you know, he says in the event and the other section, it's something whose existence, very existence, is made of alterity. It's the first thing that we get that is truly other. In the face of the approach of death, we are, he uses this phrase, we are no longer able to be able. The subject loses its very mastery of the subject. Ironically, it's this prospect of death and it's our inability to master it, which is the beginning of our salvation. It is the beginning of our path out of solitude.
Yeah.
Because we need to escape solitude. We need something that is truly, truly other. And here is this thing, death, which is truly other.
Yeah. There's a nice little transition section, 70 to 71, which gets us into, it brings up the notion of time too, which is going to show us the path, how it's a path out of solitude. Being towards death in Heidegger's authentic existence is a supreme lucidity and hence supreme virility. It is Dasein's assumption of the uttermost possibility of existence. Death in Heidegger is an event of freedom, whereas for me, the subject seems to reach the limit of the possible in suffering. It finds itself enchained, overwhelmed, and in some way passive. Death is in this sense the limit of idealism, the limit of virility, right? The limit of lucidity. This is why death is never a present. This is going on page 71. So we talked about how consciousness is a present because it has this simultaneity of the subject and object, and it is this activity, this virility. And death, which we don't experience abstractly or objectively, but which comes upon us as a mystery, also comes to us from the future. So death is the thing that introduces the notion of the future in the same way that consciousness introduced the notion of present. So we still don't have a full traditional notion of time yet, where we have past, present, future, and our experience of it in that way. But Levinas is introducing the notion of escaping. We now see how we're going to get out of solitude, or at least there's a path. We couldn't get out of consciousness, solitude, through anything present. So anytime we functioned in that structure of understanding, experiences, understanding, or knowledge, we were stuck in the present. Then in pure passivity, something happens to us, which brings us pain and suffering, which then introduces this idea of death, which brings us the idea of future. And we get this connection between consciousness and present, death and future, and we begin to see, my path out of solitude is potentially through the future.
He calls, in fact, in this death and the future section that follows, he defines the present as the fact of being master over the possible, or the now or the present. Whereas our relationship with death, which is really this unique relationship with the future, is the inability to have mastery. And the reason why the present and mastery over the possible can't relieve our solitude is because that mastery is always a way of me enveloping the thing, me remaining myself and in control of the thing. It's only when I'm not master, when I'm not in control, when I'm passive before something, that it can be so truly other than me, truly independent of me, that I am no longer solo, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Can we just reflect on how much we buy this? I mean, again,
no.
My lack of understanding of what his phenomenological method amounts to, or to the extent to which he's doing phenomenology, makes me not sure how to judge whether some of these observations are at all accurate. I don't buy for a second that we don't have any idea of the future until we have an idea of death. In fact, you know, little kids have plenty of idea of the future way before they have the idea of death. Death and suffering don't have quite the relationship. You could be afraid of death and fear, or, you know, afraid of getting hit by a car or whatever. There's not necessarily that you happen to be suffering. In fact,
does he say that we can't have a relationship with the future before we're aware of death?
Well, just the way Seth just described it is, you know, first we get this notion of death, and that gives us...
I'm not sure that that's right. I think our relationship with death is a unique relationship with the future.
Okay.
Death is where you see the first possibility of escaping solitude. He does talk about how you can come up with a notion of time. We have these notions, these hypostasized notions of time, past, present, and future, that come...
I mean, we have lots of other relationships with the future. We have plans. We have projects. We can things we can master. Most of our relationship with the future is not at all like our relationship with death.
It just seems like he's doing some kind of ontological derivation that's not really phenomenology at all. Because even to say that we wouldn't really get the notion of plurality, we wouldn't really encounter the other as other. We might encounter them as objects in the world, these faces, these people doing stuff around us. We might just treat them as objects and not really as the infinity, as the consciousness that they are, unless we have some sort of really more sophisticated take on otherness. And he thinks death is a key. Again, maybe don't use authenticity, use maturity, to have a mature take on the other. And so a real recognition of what our moral obligations are involves a recognition of death. And in so, a mature recognition of the future and a mature recognition of otherness. I could maybe buy that as the story here, but it's certainly not a straightforward developmental derivation or something that we don't, you know these things about the future and others until we know death. Death seems to be things that we don't figure out until we've reached near maturity, or maybe it is the occasion for the loss of innocence. We can go for it. That's fine. I just wanted to get that out there. So the final step, the other and the other.
Well, I was going to do the event and the other first. Do we need to say anything about the event and the other?
I thought you were already quoting from that before Seth took us back a few pages. At 75, we weren't to 75 yet. Bottom 74, the approach of death indicates that we are in relationship with something that is absolutely other, something bearing alterity, not as a provisional determination we can assimilate through enjoyment, but as something whose very existence is made
right.
of alterity.
You're right, I did quote that.
My solitude is thus not confirmed by death, but broken by it. Okay, so 75, right after that. Right away, this means that existence is pluralist. Here, the plural is not a multiplicity of existence. It appears in existing itself. A plurality insinuates itself into the very existing of the existent, which until this point was jealously assumed by the subject alone and manifest through suffering. In death, the existing of the existent is alienated. To be sure, the other that is announced does not possess this existing as the subject possesses it. Its hold over my existing is mysterious. It is not unknown but unknowable, refractory to all light. But this precisely indicates that the other is in no way another myself, participating with me in a common existence. The relationship with the other is not an idyllic and harmonious relationship of communion or sympathy through which we put ourselves in the other's place. We recognize the other as resembling us, but exterior to us. The relationship with the other is a relationship with a mystery.
And the means of relating to that will turn out to be the erotic, as he kind of hints in this section, and then we'll get fully later on.
All right. So the solution to idealism is not all of the things that some path through reason, but rather this encounter with the mystery, the absolute other. But it's also simultaneously a recognition that there's something other than myself.
All right. That's probably all we have time for, right? Or do you want to sum up any later sections here?
Oh, this is so sad.
I know.
I'm not going to get to the erotic conclusion.
I want Wes to get to the erotic. So, Wes, do you want to try to give it to us in like
give it to you.
5 or 10 minutes?
So in the other and the other, the question now becomes, once we have this relationship to something that is pure alterity, to death, now we have the problem of how we can continue to be a subject. How do we enter in a relationship to something that is wholly other without sort of being crushed by it or de-subjectified by it? Another way to think about that is, you know, how do we persevere in the face of our inevitable subjection to our passivity before death? Ultimately, the answer to this question of how we can be related to this pure alterity without losing our subjectivity, because initially, right, the question was, how do we get beyond solitude? We get pure alterity in death, but then how can we maintain our subjectivity once we've done that? Then we get this new type of relationship where we're not absorbed into another thing, or another thing is not absorbed into us. It's related, but the other thing still is itself, and that's this erotic relationship. That's the big picture.
Yes. We have to acknowledge the existence of this thing that's completely and wholly other. We have to recognize that we cannot enter into a relationship of it, which is either a relationship of knowledge, where we make it identical and subsume it under us, or ecstatic, where we subsume ourselves under it. We have to have a relationship that somehow keeps us distinct and different and doesn't collapse that and doesn't create that identity relationship. So what kind of a relationship can we enter into where we don't have that kind of unity, where we don't have that identification? And he says on page 76, I think the erotic relationship furnishes us with a prototype of it. Eros, strong as death, will furnish us with the basis of an analysis of this relationship with mystery, provided it is set forth in terms entirely different from those of the Platonism that is a world of light. So what is different about an erotic relationship from, say, a relationship of understanding or knowledge?
It's a relationship that's not fusion, and it's not the having power over. So the erotic relationship is not the relationship of having power or mastery over something. It is a relationship with something that is always evading us. What we get out of this is ultimately, he uses the word communication instead of mastery. And he thinks of the erotic object as essentially feminine, in the sense that he's associating femininity with things like modesty and with a kind of withdrawal from the light. The feminine is always hiding itself, always slipping away from the light, in contrast to, say, eternally remains a mystery.
That would be the feminine as opposed to the two-dimensional person with the vector of desire that we talked about earlier.
Feminine plays hard to get. So let's see if we can find a good quote here. The pathos of love, however, consists in an insurmountable duality of beings. It is a relationship with what always slips away. The relationship does not ipso facto neutralize alterity, but preserves it. The pathos of voluptuousness lies in the fact of being two. As other is not here an object that becomes ours or becomes us, to the contrary, it withdraws into its mystery. Neither does this mystery of the feminine. The feminine, essentially other, refer to any romantic notions of the mysterious, unknown, or misunderstood woman. You know, he'll go on to talk about this voluptuousness. So, for instance, the example of caressing. So the caress is a mode of the subject's being where the subject who is in contact with another goes beyond this contact. The seeking of the caress constitutes its essence by the fact that the caress does not know what it seeks. This not knowing, this fundamental disorder, is the essential. It is the game with something slipping away, a game absolutely without project or plan, not with what can become ours or us, but with something other, always inaccessible, always still to come. Caress is the anticipation of the pure future without content. It is made up of this increase of hunger, of ever-rich promises, opening new perspectives onto the ungraspable. It feeds on countless hungers. So I think what's important here is he's getting at this sense in which the erotic relationship is never fully satisfied, and it never is exactly what it is. So if you have a physical relationship with someone, you might want to think about that on the analogy of possession, or let's say, hey, look, I've made contact. Levinas is wrong. It's not continually escaping me. But what you want in the caress, there's a significance to it that goes beyond mere physical contact, right? The mere physical contact is not what you want. You want something in the other person that you don't exactly get with just touch, that's always evading you, always slipping away from you. And so even though you might get to touch a person, you're always left wanting more. That's the erotic relationship.
I think there's also an element in this. I don't think he says it explicitly, but if you think of Eros's love, that love is something that you cannot make someone love you. You cannot demand it. You cannot manufacture it. You cannot make it happen. At least not love that comes from where somebody who's fully inhabited in their own sovereignty offers you something like that. And so we have the notion of unrequited love. And it's this relationship of love between two beings, which is where no matter what you do, ultimately the act of receiving love or being loved is passive. And there's obviously a tremendous amount of anticipation and frustration and desire and lack of fulfillment of desire that comes with that relationship. It's much more in line with what I think he's driving at than the traditional relationship that we're talking about.
Well, I think loving is itself passive in the sense that there's no grasping or mastery to it. You are always up against something that you don't grasp. You're always up against something that you don't have. You know, the last paragraph of that section, he's making a lot of out of the fact that there is no grasping or possessing or knowing in love. If one could possess, grasp, and know the other, it would not be other. Possessing, knowing, and grasping are synonyms of power. And then he goes on to say, I've precisely wanted to contest the idea that the relationship with the other is fusion. So you don't get to fuse with the other as well. But the other thing I thought about was Plato's Symposium, where there's a lot made out of the fact that, so in Aristophanes' myth, you're separated from your other half, and then your erotic relationship is always to seek that half. But all you get is copulation. You don't actually get to merge with the other person. You don't get actually to be whole again. That's very frustrating. So as a consolation prize, the gods give us reproductivity. They give us creativity. In other words, you get, and this is why I think he talks about fecundity and the idea of being a father at the end of this, paternity. Because we can't fuse with the loved one, our consolation prize is this child who is sort of an image of both parents. He's sort of a whole thing. He's sort of a symbol of the union that we wanted. And that goes the same, not just for literally for children, but for all of our creative, reproductive acts. The erotic relationship is essentially one of reproductivity. We don't get the fusion we want, but we get to create new things that are symbols of that fusion.
And a child is also something that is both me and not me. It's something in which I can participate, but maintains its alterity.
Yep. And we could think of that in general in any creative act. Because there's an element, right? I think we have to think more broadly than just having children. Because when we talk about fecundity, thinking about creativity in general and all the things we might do as artists or any kind of creative work. So if I write a story, you know, if I'm Shakespeare and I'm writing The Tempest, I am putting myself in this sort of godlike position of having power and control over all these things. And I might see creativity as a form of power and control. And then I create this art object. It's mine. It's a emblem of my mastery. And I put it out there for other people to admire. Well, I think on this model, that's a misunderstanding of the essence of creativity. Also, there's a moment of mastery in creativity, but there's also a moment of passivity where I let the object be itself. It is other in a sense. Shakespeare's characters do come alive. They're not simply products of his agenda, let's say. I know it's kind of a loose way of talking about things, but that's the telling sort of example here.
I was just looking at page 91, this kind of long description of paternity is the relationship with a stranger who entirely while being other is myself. The relationship of the ego with a myself who is nonetheless a stranger to me. And then goes on negatively. The son is not simply my work like a poem, an artifact. He's not my property. Neither the categories of power nor of having can indicate the relationship with the child. Neither the notion of cause nor the notion of ownership permit one to grasp the fact of fecundity. I do not have my child. I am in some way my child. But the words I am here have a significance different than that from an Eleatic or Platonic significance. There's a multiplicity and a transcendence in this verb to exist, a transcendence that is lacking even in the boldest existential analyses. Then again, the son is not any event whatsoever that happens to me. Lastly, the alterity of the son is not that of an alter ego. It's not a sympathy through which I can put myself in the son's place. It is through my being, not through sympathy, that I am my son. Yeah, I just found this whole section rather hard to sympathize with. It seemed, I can see the way you told the story, Wes, of this being the sort of consolation, you know, telling it through Aristophanes's, that makes a poetic sense. But in terms of the actual argument, I like the idea of Eros as, even though I think the goal of Eros, you know, as Aristophanes says, is to be ecstatic, is to merge. And I think if it's done successfully, you get a lot of that feeling. You know, maybe your hearts are beating in unison. There's a lot of, there's simultaneous orgasms.
That's not merger, though.
It's as close as we can get. Since earlier in the essay, he talked about ecstasis as something where the self gets obliterated. I mean, it just seems either you have to admit that ecstasis is simply not possible at all, or you have to admit that it is a legitimate way to overcome solitude. You can't both say, oh, well, no, the real way to overcome solitude is you have to retain your individuality while grasping the other. Like, okay, that could be an experience, but why is that the only way to overcome solitude?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good point, because I think when we were talking about that, I didn't quite understand why he was rejecting ecstasy ultimately as a way of overcoming solitude. Do you guys remember his reasoning about that?
I think it's just what we're saying, that the solution to the existential problem he's after is remaining yourself, remaining a fully developed self while having a relationship, a connection with a mystery, with an other.
Yeah, maybe if we lose ourselves in the other, yeah, there's no solitude, but there's no self either. So, you know, maybe that's the point. And then,
right. Codependent relationships or something like that. Yeah. So I think you could convert this to a psychology of like what makes for a healthy relationship where you're really respecting the other person for what he or she is in themselves and not as an appendage of yours.
Not seeking to fulfill a desire through them.
Exactly.
I think that's the failure of the erotic, Wes. He invokes Freud.
So I like the story about the erotic here, but when it got to the fecundity, to the last one, he just lost me there. I didn't.
Well, you're also the only one of the three of us that has kids, so maybe you don't romanticize the notion because you've actually lived it.
But I think, you know, if you draw the parallel with the symposium, the alterity of the reproductive product, because love is ultimately, you know, for Plato, is about reproduction. That's really what makes it great. If it were just, we lost our other halves and we get copulation, and that's the erotic relationship, that doesn't give us as much of what we want as actually creating things, because we can create things that are wholes, whether it's a child or a work of art.
Well, and I'll buy that the creation of these things, and obviously if it's a person, you're acknowledging that there are other people and that they're important. But even with a work of art, you know, unless you have a very solipsistic view of art, it's something that you want to live on. It's something you want to be appreciated by other people. It's supposed to have its place in something besides your own mind, in an objective world somehow. So if we're trying to get at ways of getting a mature grasp of time, then yeah, you know, knowing sort of, I will live on through my kids, like that entirely makes sense to me. And I will live on through my artworks. I will live on through all this stuff, you know, as ways of conquering death insofar as it can be conquered. Yeah, connecting to the other, that entirely makes sense. So I guess I buy this basic story about the other as needed to establish the objectivity of time, that you would never get that if you were just by yourself in a vat or even on an island, but I'm more thinking like in a sensory deprivation chamber. You know, maybe in fact you're already a mature adult, but you get amnesia and then dumped in a sensory deprivation chamber. You're not going to sort of recover the notion of time from that. You would just be in the eternal presence and the suffering of the impossibility of escape. You would never get a real idea of your own death or of any of these other sorts of things. Having people there is required to get those things. I mean, it seems the more profound philosophical impact of this is supposed to be the thing that we emphasized in our last episode, is getting ethics out of this. But to say that in order to have a proper ethics and a proper understanding of the grasp of the other, you have to have kids or have erotic experience, that we've already kind of gone beyond. This was in the sections that we skipped where he reestablished the ethical imperative. So I think everything after that is gravy. Any other closing thoughts?
I will say that we glossed over, how does time emerge from the relationship with the other? Mark, I know you just gave some good descriptions of that, possibilities, I think, for what Levinas means, but I think it's not entirely clear. Actually, there is the power and the relationship with the other section where he sort of says, I do not define the other by the future, but the future by the other. So we get the sense of futurity from the other, but it's unclear to me how exactly that is. I understand the whole thing about death and all that, but unless one of you can quickly say something about that, it'll remain a mystery.
Well, one of the things that the intro to this book, again, not his preface, but the translator's intro, stressed, I believe, was how between this and his later works, in this work, his other early work, he talked about this in terms of the future. And later, he actually talked mostly in terms of the past. And I think either of them is sort of obvious. Like, you wouldn't have a notion of history without being connected to other people. So it's maybe a little more of a stretch to talk about the future in terms of that, but not that much more of a stretch. But clearly, like, just thinking about, again, I see the book, I think about where it must have come from, that somebody else must have built it. It seems those things all come together, and you don't have to have a solipsistic, I'm not even looking at other people in the eyes, I'm only looking at the things and deducing that the other people, you don't have to have that sort of take. You can have a very face-to-face take on our experience with the other and still think that that gives you the notion, the full notion of time and history. But I do think that just reading this by itself was not enough to make this clear. We would have to really understand Heidegger's point of time, which again, in that episode, we just kind of summed up in a few sentences. We didn't have time to get into that. We didn't read those sections. And also Bergson on time, which we did, you know, the start of Bergson, this thing on metaphysics where we talked about grasping time as a whole. And Levinas is on board with Bergson's project of, no, we don't grasp a timeline that stretches off to infinity from the present and forward. Phenomenological reality is more like, you know, what we attributed to Augustine, is the present is the only thing that seems real right now. And so how do we get all the rest of it out of there? Is it just out of some sort of abstraction? Is it like, you know, Kant says that we construct it?
Here's my guess at what he's saying. So in the power and the relationship of the other section, he does suggest that when we encounter the other, as in other human beings, we encounter their future. That's a raw ontological part of that encounter. Think about this in terms of his grounding and ethics. We might think of the future as sort of arising out of respect for the other and their possibilities, right? There's a sense in which time arises out of one's ethical comportment to the other, because that ethical comportment involves respecting their extension forward in time, not ending them and their possibilities, not thwarting, you know, you get the idea. But that's a guess.
Next time, we are going to have a special episode where we're going to return to an old reading that somebody hired us basically to do this, to return to as a wedding gift to one of her friends. They wanted us to dedicate an episode to them. So we're going to return to Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. We only just in our one of our first episodes read just the first couple chapters of that. Now we're going to read chapters 7 through 10, which are about friendship, among other things. So looking forward to that.
I think we should start holding readings hostage. Like, we will never, ever, ever do this book unless listeners pony up the cash.
From now on, all future episodes will be sponsored by whoever pays for them, and we will cover whatever. You know what will happen is some asshole who has a lot of money would force us to read all of Ayn Rand.
No, they can't force us. We don't have to do anything we don't want, but we take everything off the table in this. Anyway.
We would just say no to the deal. But That is the best way. If you've been like, God damn, why haven't they covered Malebranche yet? I really want them to cover Malebranche.
Yeah.
There's different prices for different philosophers. So,
yeah. I was just going to say, it would be interesting to see. Would the price be related to the popularity and weight of the work or the obscurity and annoyance on our part of having to?
Yes, this is a supply and demand problem. The more obscure they are, the more they cost.
Well, thank you, guys. That's so great having you on again, Seth.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
It's okay having you on, Wes. It's okay.
Well, it's great having you on, Mark.
Yeah.
I feel that I respect your otherness, both of you, and no erotic activity was needed.
This activity is actually highly erotic in a broad sense. It's an act of love creating podcasts.
It is.
These are our children that we have procreated together. As disturbing as I know that is for you. But.
These podcasts are mine and simultaneously wholly other than me, which is my way of making sure that I can divorce myself from liability.
Yeah, exactly. What you guys say is wholly
the
other.
LLC defense.
What I said is my identity. This is my hypostasis.
For those who have attended addiction treatment without success, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone. Gulf Breeze Recovery is a non-12-step holistic treatment facility that is successful in helping people break free from the addictive lifestyle. Visit gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-6-HOLISTIC-REHAB.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Through the night, I lie awake, staring into darkness. My body aches, and then at dawn, I search the room. Darkness still persists in me, eternal gloom. Don't know much at all. At least I can call on. I can call on you. Lay it all on you. I wish that I could leave you, but that will never be true. I will always call on you. Let me